This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 147 was pre-recorded earlier this month to air on December 27th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. We'll be deviating from our usual format for our final episode of 2018. Today's episode will be a review of the best moments on Macro Voices in the past year. We'll play clips from some of our best interviews and discuss how our guests' predictions compared with what the market actually brought us. We'll be back to our regular format next week.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, I really enjoyed going through these past clips, and I encourage all of our listeners to enjoy the back catalog of interviews, which go all the way back to our very first interview with Jim Rogers, all the way back on February of 2016. Now, we've added a search function to our homepage at macrovoices.com, so you can easily search by guest name for past interviews. Macro Voices is brought to you by the generous donations of our listeners. So if you've donated to Macro Voices in 2018, we'd like to thank you again for helping make this program possible. Now, if you've enjoyed Macro Voices this year, we hope you consider making a donation this holiday season. You'll find a donate button on the homepage at macrovoices.com. Now, for our first clip, let's go back to December 7th of 2017, where you and I together were talking about Bitcoin in one of our post-game episodes. During that time, we were seeing Bitcoin basically going parabolic. We were rising, and at the time of recording, we were approaching 17,000 on the upside of Bitcoin. So let's have a listen and how the conversation went. All right, Eric. So listen, all of our listeners are waiting for us to talk Bitcoin. So let's get right to it. Now, you know, I want to start off with Zero Hedge has this big headline running, which is basically Bitcoin berserker run resumes. And one of the interesting things that they pointed out there is how long it's taking this cryptocurrency to cross key psychological levels. So they make the point that going from zero to 1,000 took 1,789 days. Going from 2,000 to 3,000 took, you know, 23 days, and then it goes from 6,000 to 7,000 took 13 days. You know, to go from 10,000 to 11,000 took 1 day. Then it, you know, go from 14,000 to 15,000 took 10 hours. From 16,000 to 17,000, 2 hours. And then from 18,000 to 19,000, 3 minutes. Like what we're seeing is like this parabolic crazy run on the upside of Bitcoin. And everyone is just, the amount of text messages I've been getting from members and family about, well, should I buy Bitcoin? What's going on with Bitcoin? It's just amazing, just the euphoria that's going on right now.
What we're seeing here is on no positive change in fundamentals. The price is accelerating dramatically to the upside, and people, for no other reason than because the price is accelerating, are just going into a mania. And what blows my mind, the interactions on Twitter today, so many people were in my face because I've been a skeptic of Bitcoin. And the essence of what I think their point was, ha ha, you stupid idiot, look at the price now. You were wrong when you said it's in a bubble. And it's like, dude, when the price goes up $1,000 in 3 minutes on no change in fundamentals, that's not disproving my opinion that the price is in a bubble. It's proving it in spades.
You know, Eric, I'm going to stick my neck out here and at the risk of having egg all over my face. But, you know, I really can't help but to feel that this is all going to come to an end quickly here, because while I'm not going to make a prediction on the final price, but the one thing when you study bubbles through history and when they get into this final parabolic phase, while the price level is not always transparent, what will be the final price that it prints, the one thing we have a pretty good gauge on is time, because gravity at some point is going to take over. You can't just have it going up 1,000 points in 3 minutes and it just gets to this parabolic phase without at some point it hitting its head. So I actually think that we're going to see short to intermediate high on Bitcoin this year. We'll see whether or not I'm right.
Patrick, in the interest of full disclosure, I've got to call you out because in that clip, you said you were not going to make any price forecast yourself. In actuality, when you later, just a few, couple of weeks after that clip was recorded, when you produced your Big Picture Trading 2018 forecast, you did make a call. You predicted it would lose 90% of its value. We got to score you as wrong on that because we've only lost 80% of the value.
85%,
so far.
Eric. 85%.
Okay. All right, 85. Well, I suppose by that argument, you could say you still got a week left since we're recording this in the middle of the month. By the time our listeners hear that, maybe it will have lost 90% of its value. I'll tell you what, we're gonna count that one as a win on your part, even if it was only 85%. You got the gist of it.
I think when I made that call, I think I chose 90% more for shock factor than some sort of arithmetic way of calculating what it's, I mean, its real value is zero. But in the end, I just simply thought that after a bubble burst like that, without it having a fundamental base, it was going to be a much deeper market throwback. Like when we saw the parabolic rise in silver, which was the very same type of chart back in, that I think it's back in 2011, silver was approaching $50, but silver is a real asset that way. And so expecting, let's say, silver to wipe out 90% was not the same scenario as what it was with Bitcoin, but it was a crazy drop.
Patrick, I've got to disagree with you when you say the value is zero. And I do want to clarify this because I've been misquoted on this point so much this year. I don't think the value of Bitcoin is zero. Even after it's outlawed, there will always be a black market for Bitcoin. And it's next to impossible to regulate the Bitcoin network out of existence, even after it becomes illegal to use it. And I predict there will always be a black market. Now, I don't think Bitcoins are going to be worth more than $100, but I don't think the value is zero.
Now, Eric, I want to quickly move to several weeks after that December 7th clip when, again, in the post game, we were talking about Bitcoin closer to 19,000, and you gave some really good advice to our listeners. So why don't we have a listen?
But its days are numbered. And I think that if you're one of those 1,000 people that are hoarding and, you know, kind of holding out, dude, diversify. If you're worth millions or hundreds of millions of dollars secretly in Bitcoin that nobody knows about, figure out how to diversify at least 10 or 20 million of that into cash so that you're still a rich guy when this Bitcoin fiasco is over, because it's a charade and it's not going to last. I don't know how it ends, but diversify some of that wealth out. And I certainly don't begrudge anybody who has, you know, made a lot of money on Bitcoin. That's fantastic. My hat's off to you. You picked the right thing to gamble on. But it is gambling. It's not investing. There is no intrinsic value in Bitcoin. And it doesn't have fiat value. It doesn't make any sense. And it's also now, in all history, in terms of percent appreciation, just this week, Bitcoin has eclipsed the Dutch tulip mania in terms of being the biggest bubble in recorded history. Now's a really good time to, you know, if you want to stay with this thing, great, but why not cash out half of your wealth in Bitcoin into good old-fashioned fiat currency, just in case it turns out that us non-believers are proven right and governments outlaw this thing and it ends up collapsing to zero.
So great advice, Eric. And I think a number of our listeners were able to take advantage of your advice. So now if they cashed in some of that money and diversified, what should they do now?
Donate it to Macro Voices.
Well, all joking aside there, Eric, you obviously wrote the book on this now just recently. How's your thinking changed in the last month?
Well, it has changed a lot, and for people who read the book, they already know the punchline here. But basically, what we need to remember is that although it was very easy to see that Bitcoin was a bubble that was certain to burst, as it has, that doesn't mean that digital currency technology isn't going to change the world. I think it is going to change the world. It's just that Bitcoin was never likely to be a big part of that story. Most of the industry is still very confused about this, and as I described in my book, we need to separate cryptocurrency from digital currency technology. Digital currency technology will change the world. Cryptocurrency probably won't be a big part of that story. And, you know, the book tells the whole story, so I'm not going to belabor it here. Patrick, let's move on now to a different subject, which is the whole volatility complex basically blew up in the beginning of February 2018. But we had several guests on the program who predicted that. I believe Francisco Filia was the first back in November. Tell us a little bit more about that clip and let's hear it.
Absolutely. So back on November 22nd, we had Francesco on the show, and near the end of his conversation that we had the conversation on the vol, but let's have a listen and then we'll talk about it.
Moving on, I see a topic that's very much near and dear to my heart, which is this whole short vol trade. When this started, there were a few institutions that should have known better that were shorting vol to take advantage of that contango yield in the futures curve. Now we've gotten to the point where people I know tell me that they go to the restaurant and the waitress in the restaurant is short vol through the ETF. That's one of those moments where you know there's a problem, is when the waitress in the restaurant is short vol and clearly doesn't have a thorough understanding of what risk is inherent to that. Tell us, you've got several slides here. Tell us the highlights of this short vol situation and what can go wrong.
The short vol situation is really like a pressure cooker in the market nowadays. It is not as big in terms of number of billions involved with the strategy, but it is big in terms of the closeness that you got to a wipeout event. So what is surprising here is not so much that it can lose money, anything can lose money, but how quickly it can lose 100% of the money invested in the strategy. The theory goes, for whenever you want to short volatility, that for you to really run into troubles, you need to have volatility doubling up from current levels in a short manner. And the theory goes that it never happened in the past. Now, the problem is that, at the moment, volatility, as measured by the VIX on the S&P, is only 9. So for it to double up, it really only requires for it to go to 20, right? And guess what? 20 is the historical average. 20 is no less, no more than the historical average. So for it to move quickly into 20, it wouldn't be able to surprise anybody because it's just where it's been most of the time in history. It's just the norm, it's not the exception. So here you have a point in time in which if it ever was able to go to 20, and to go to 20 just really takes the S&P to drop for any reason on a number of days, a short number of days, by 5%. So it doesn't take much. And if it ever was to go to 20, we calculated here in these few slides and in our further research that a number of ETFs linked to short volatility positions would be close to be wiped out. And wipe out is defined as losing more than 75% of the capital. And within the contracts that you have embedded sometimes liquidity gates and termination events, which means you lose more than that, the note gets withdrawn. So it is a really big problem, and it is the closest analogy I would find is the one of a pressure cooker at present.
So, Patrick, I think the pressure cooker analogy is absolutely apt, and it's really telling to me because so many people, when we saw this vol blow up occur, were saying, oh my God, nobody could have seen it coming. It was just this impossible to see coming rogue wave event. You know, Patrick, Francesco is clearly a visionary guy, but he's not the only one who saw this, and we had it on our program. A lot of other people saw it. That was at least 10 weeks before this all fell apart, and as he explained, all that it would take would be for S&P volatility to move back to historical norms to cause a wipeout event that could result in 75% or more of those XIV holdings being lost. And that's exactly what happened. Yet, despite the fact that we covered it and other people in financial media covered it, people acted like it was this impossible to foresee circumstance when it happened. And it's really amazing to me that people act like these things are unforeseeable when so many people foresaw them.
Well, you know what? Before we even comment further, let's play the clips. We had Kevin Muir join us from the Macro Tourist in the post game that followed Francesco's interview. And we had a great conversation with him. And then you and Kevin got into a pretty good exchange talking about the risks in the VIX. So let's actually play that.
So that means that if you had gone and shorted that the returns for the risk is just unbelievable.
Well, and it's of course the nature, I think, of the way that the finance, and this is to me one of the major failings of academic finance, is it is believed that volatility and risk are almost the same thing, and they're not. Volatility is a proxy for risk in the case of normally distributed returns, which is not the way the real world works. And this has been an incredibly, just a cash cow for so many people. It's going to end very badly someday. And I think that's what's missing. Nothing is that good unless it has the other side of the coin. And that side of the coin just hasn't been flipped yet.
Eric, you're absolutely correct. And Interactive Brokers, one of the largest electronic brokers out there, realizes the risk. And if you go look at the way that they're margining these products, they're margining them completely different than what the exchanges and everyone else says is the proper amount. So if you go look at the VIX futures, the front month is 6,200. The exchange minimum is 6,200, which works out to roughly 50% of a contract. The next month is 4,000, which works out to 30% of a contract. And the farm months are 2,500, which works out to 17% of a contract. But if you go to Interactive Brokers and you want to sell this VIX contract short, you have to put up 300-400% of the contract, because they've gone and they've looked at it and they've realized that if the S&P has a 10% down move, which isn't out of the realm of possibility, that the VIX could spike up to $37 really easily. And people are going to be wiped out if that happens.
Yeah, and I don't think that what the people who are shorting the VIX understand is what this really means is, let's suppose that everybody wanted some kind of portfolio insurance where somebody would be there to bail things out if things turn bad, if this systemic risk that Francesco talks about shows up and we have a really dramatic stock market risk. Suppose that I want to have some kind of insurance policy where somebody else is going to be the one to absorb the loss. It's the people that are buying these short VIX products that are volunteering to be the ones that will be the sacrificial cows when things fall apart. And I don't think they know that that's what they're signing up for.
No, you're absolutely correct. There's $1.2 billion of the XIV, which is the short ETF. There's $1.3 billion of the SVXY, which is another short one. These are staggering numbers. And
you guys just nailed it in that conversation. I mean, what's your thinking now that you've listened back to it?
Well, I think it's really important to distinguish here. It's true that we sort of nailed a call in terms of what did happen, but there's also something that hasn't happened yet, and that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. As Chris Cole has told us, and we'll get to his clips in just a minute, folks, there's more coming here, and we probably have not seen the end of this story. But what we just discussed, as Kevin said, is the financial industry is getting smart about protecting itself, and we're seeing things like Interactive Brokers over-margining these VIX products, because they see the risk that the exchanges are not really taking seriously, and they want to protect themselves from taking any losses. But there's no systemic risk to the financial system itself. Let's get into the next clip where Kevin makes some comments, and I want to talk more about systemic risk next.
The VIX isn't something that's arbitrageable. Like, it's not like you can actually go and buy VIX. What you can do is buy futures that expire into it. And yes, you can go and hedge in the options, but realistically, what you're betting on is what the future implied volatility will be. And so that means that we could get a situation where it could trade significantly above the actual underlying. We could see the VIX trading at 20, but futures are trading at 40 or 50. This could happen in a situation where there's just no natural sellers. Right now, all you can see is seller after seller after seller. But what happens when all of a sudden this turns on them and they're all offside and they need to get it back? It could be scary. I'm actually in Jesse Felder's camp that this is one of the big risks for the market right now.
Well, I think it's even bigger than what you've described so far. I agree with you. It's huge, because the way that futures work is, if you get underwater on your position, you owe money back to the broker and the exchange. You know, it's not a question of just your account went to zero, you lost all your money and you're done. It's you lost all your money, you ended up with a negative balance, and you've got to come up with money, you know, sell your house, sell your car in order to come up with the money to cover that deficit. Stocks don't work that way. So when you've got a stock, which is what ETFs are, you know, so you look at something like XIV, it's basically organized as an equity security, which invests in shorting VIX futures. So if they're massively short VIX futures, and VIX futures have a dramatic 1987 size move up, and they're negative equity, which means they owe the exchange $1 billion, And there's no capital left because the value of the XIV has gone to zero. They had a plan. They thought they were going to unwind it by buying futures quickly, and it didn't work. Well, then what do they do? And the answer is, at that point, the company that organized the ETF, maybe they get wiped out, but that's not very much capital. Now what you end up with is the exchange fails. And at that point, you've got, you know, anything can happen because regulators have to look at how to protect the system overall. Do they end up saying the people that were on the other side of that trade get whistled out somehow because, of, you know, they can't let the exchange fail? There's so many things that can go so incredibly badly wrong. What happens if XIV is in margin deficit and owes $200 million or $2 billion to the exchange? Who's going to come up with the money? Then what?
Eric, that exchange between you and Kevin was just phenomenal. And, you know, I have to say, you talked about a lot of different risks. And the question I have for you, which ones actually happened and which ones have not yet happened? And do you still believe that they're risks today?
Absolutely critically important topic, Patrick. Thank you for that question. It's really important to see what happened here, folks. As Kevin was describing in the earlier clip, okay, so you've got financial institutions like Interactive Brokers increasing their margin requirements. They see what's coming. They know we're headed for trouble. And Patrick, I'm convinced that the people who organized the XIV ETN knew what was coming. They didn't know when, but they knew it was coming someday. And what they did in this case is they were extremely diligent, and they managed to take very rapid action to unwind that product as soon as it hit its risk parameters. That wiped out 100% or 93%, whatever the number was, more than 90% of the equity of the investors. But guess what, Patrick? The folks that brought you that wonderful product, they made all their fees and they never took any loss because they managed to unwind that sucker before it got into that negative equity situation where suddenly it's not only did they wipe out all of the capital, but they wiped out 200% of the capital. And now all of a sudden the fund itself owes the exchange a bunch of money and there's no place to source it. They managed to not let that happen. And the result was 100% wipeout of their retail investors' money. They didn't lose anything. The risk we were talking about, and it could have happened, but it didn't in this case, was if things got a little bit more out of control, they might not have been able to unwind it in time. They might have wound up in a negative equity situation. We talked to Devin Anderson about this earlier in the year, where potentially you get to the XIV owing billions of dollars that it doesn't have to an exchange. That could have created a systemic risk that could have had a cascade effect that could have taken down the entire financial system. Thankfully, none of those really big risks happened. But later, when we talked to Chris Cole, he assured us, hey, guys, the things that I'm talking about haven't happened yet. That February thing, that was a warm-up. The really big event has not yet happened. So this is still something that's very much on our radar as we look into 2019.
Well, now that you mentioned Chris Cole, let's get to Chris. We had him on the show in a very timely manner on the 25th of January was when we aired our interview with him titled Volatility and the Alchemy of Risk. And we had a great chat with him and he nailed it. And literally a week later, the Vol event actually happened. So why don't we take a listen to the clip and see what was on Chris's mind at the time?
Yeah, the shortfall trade, if you look at short volatility and you think about what volatility really is, it's the bet on stability. It's a bet on stability. And when you're betting on stability, that's a myriad of different bets. Part of that is the expectation that markets remain low volatility or low realized volatility. Part of that is a short gamma bet. So there's this implicit short gamma exposure. There's part of that is a bet against that correlations remain stable or that different market relationships remain anti-correlated with one another and that or implied correlations are dropping or and then realized correlations are dropping. And the other aspect of the short volatility bet is that interest rates remain low or go lower. So if we look at each of these different factors, these are the risk exposures that you will have when you own a portfolio of short options. If you own a portfolio of short options, you're short vega, you're short gamma, you're short correlation, you're short interest rates. Well, what we've seen now with the short vol trade, both explicitly and implicitly, is that various financial engineering strategies out there that have become dominant in the marketplace, I mean, we're talking about the largest hedge funds in the world employ these strategies, that are just replicating the exposures of a short option portfolio. So when you add all this exposure together, we have this self-reflexive short straddle of financially engineered strategies in the market. And this really comes out to about $2 trillion worth of implicit and explicit short volatility strategies. And then you can tack on the share buybacks to some effect that is resulting in this. Leading into 1987, portfolio insurance comprised about 2% of the market, leading into Black Monday. And that was a reflexive strategy. Today, anywhere between 6 to 10% of the market is comprised of these self-reflexive, implicit and explicit shortfall strategies. And this should be concerning.
Or what do you think the catalyst might be, and what could the potential blowback be if this were to start to unwind in the other direction?
Sure. There's a lot to talk about on that topic. You know, first of all, on the short VIX trade, I think it's interesting because now it's become very popular to talk about that. I think if you go back and read Artemis's research, dating back as far as 2014, we talked about how it really just a 65% move in the VIX could be all that it would take to wipe out those products. We actually presented our numbers years ago on that. I think it's become a very popular thing to talk about today. I think these short vol products, these ETNs, it's really funny because you have to be Artemis runs a hedge fund, and the regulators are going to require you to be a accredited investor and pass all these tests to invest in a hedge fund that trades volatility in a risk-controlled and smart manner, and that's largely going long vol in an intelligent way. Meanwhile, anyone on the street can go out and buy a double-levered VIX ETN or a short-biased VIX ETN. So there's a great irony to this. And I think that these products are a class action lawsuit waiting to happen. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
Eric, you know, it's funny that he says it's not if, but when. And that when happened to be exactly a week later. What about that for timing?
Well, but let's really be clear, because that's actually not quite accurate. What he talked about in that clip was the combination of both explicit and implicit short vol trades that he sees tremendous systemic risk associated with. What actually happened a week later was just the tip of the iceberg, just the explicit short vol through the ETNs. That's the part that blew up in February. And we did have Chris back on the program in our post-game segment after it happened. We don't have a clip of that today. But he told us, he said, look, what happened in February was not the big risk event that I'm worried about. That was nothing. The really big event is yet to come. So we're definitely going to need to work on getting Chris back on the program in 2019 as we continue to keep an eye on this risk.
Eric, let's move on. I want to move on to the topic of China. Now, we had Darius Dale on our show back on the 12th of April, and we started talking about the subject of China. Now, just to put some context for our listeners, the China A50 peaked in January of 2018, and at the time of the interview, the index has already corrected from a 15,000 level down to about 13,000, and a lot of questions were asked asking, has China rolled over? What's going on in China? So why don't we have a listen to the clip, and then we'll chat about it.
A theme that we've heard a lot about from our other guests is the risk if China sees a slowdown, or worse yet, a blow up of their massive credit expansion, it could send shockwaves throughout the global economy. I see you've got a sequence of slides here talking about China slowing. Tell us what you see on the horizon here.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess we don't make grandiose calls from a macro perspective. You know, sort of if you think about any process that's very data driven and very centric on identifying where you might be on a sine curve for something as simple as growth or inflation. Well, I guess it's not simple, but for something that's as integral as growth and inflation, the last thing you sort of wind up with is, you know, these sort of big bang risk calls. And in fact, I would say one of the better calls we've ever made as a firm is sort of taking the other side of the yuan devaluation fears in early 2016. But again, you know, much like Europe and the U.S., China's kind of in the wrong place from the perspective of its sine curve. So what we show on slide 43, the whole world effectively responded to the bottoming of the Chinese economy and the massive acceleration we've seen, you know, that persisted from, you know, the early part of 2016 all the way through, you know, sort of the early mid part of 2017. On the left chart here, we got a global industrial production on a GDP weighted basis, and then the global corporate profits. And what you see is that everything bottomed on a lag to China and accelerated on a lag to China's acceleration. Why did that happen on slide 44? Well, if you go back, I think a lot of investors probably missed this. We definitely didn't nail the bottom in this, but I think in hindsight, you know, hindsight being 2020, you can sort of see exactly why that happened. So if you look at the Fed dot plot, Fed turning dovish multiple times in the latter part of 2015 into peak deflation fears in the early part of 2016, you know, that sort of alleviated a decent amount of the capital outflow pressure that we had seen in the Chinese economy, because that sort of capped the upside in the dollar from a broad trade rate perspective. So that allowed the PBOC and Beijing to sort of combine fiscal and monetary easing. That was at peak. That was basically the biggest easing package that we've seen in modern Chinese history, if you sort of combine both the fiscal and monetary impulse that obviously had a pretty material impact on the Chinese economy, which we show on slide 45. So the red line in the chart on the left is really what investors should focus on. So nominal GDP, this is nominal GDP in secondary industries in China. So manufacturing, construction, heavy industry fell to almost 0% by the end of 2015. We would argue that's one of the causal reasons for deflation. But again, everything is reflexive. Okay, so all that stimulus that Beijing and the PBOC imparted upon the Chinese economy caused that red line to hook up all the way back to 14-15% by the beginning of 2017. What's important about that is that we've gone back to levels of investment growth that policymakers in China have previously identified as a level that creates a tremendous amount of financial instability. So we definitely don't see them responding quickly to any sort of downturn associated with sort of this reverting back to some more normalized mean. You know, we don't expect it to crash, because we definitely think Beijing is very keen to avoid a 2015-style collapse. Certainly something that, you know, they've learned their lesson from. But we definitely think the impulse of these charts is lower, not higher. And a lot of the reflation we've seen over the past couple of years, you know, particularly across emerging markets, has been a direct function of this recovery in Chinese demand. We show that on slide 46, just sort of showing Asian export growth. That chart, much like the global industrial production chart and global corporate profit chart, they all sort of mirror this progression in the Chinese economy on the lag.
So, Eric, when we had Darius from Hedgeye come on, they were really getting bearish generally on the not only U.S. growth, but on the idea that China could even recover in a full way. Now, they weren't thinking of a 2015 repeat, but really, to be honest, the Chinese stock market has truly remained very weak. At the time when we interviewed Darius, the China A50 was down almost 20% at the time of the recording. And since then, it has dropped down about another 13% further lower, down about 28% altogether from the peak to the trough. But what's interesting is that more or less since July till present, almost 6 months straight, the China A50 has been pinned in this 10,800 to 11,800 range. And one of the more interesting things will be for the 2019 is, will this resolve itself with another big breakdown in the China A50, or is this a bigger bottoming formation? It's something that I'm going to be watching for sure.
And something else, Patrick, that we discussed with Darius in that interview is that it's not just China, but really all of the global markets were looking a lot weaker than the U.S., and Darius expected them to continue to get worse, and that's exactly what's happened. Now, of course, we recorded this year-end show in the middle of December, but it's already looking as though the Santa Claus rally may not happen after all, and we may have a pretty red close to the end of the year. Our listeners will certainly know when they hear this whether or not that has panned out that way. I want to move on, though, to May 10th, when we had Charles Gav on the program. In the post-game segment, at that point, folks, think back to May. Almost everybody is thinking the world is coming to an end. The crash started in February. Everybody thinks it's headed down. But you made a call in the post-game segment, Patrick, where you said that at least temporarily, and you were careful to say it's not a complete reversal, but at least temporarily, we needed to see some upside relief in the market. Let's go ahead and play that clip now.
A
first comment just on volume. I mean, one of the interesting observations I'd make is that lower volume into a summer rally actually would fit the narrative of it, this being a bigger topping formation. I mean, if we had a real high volume breakout, then it could be a full resumption of the bull market. And so, in fact, this sort of fits the narrative quite well. If this entire rally heads right back and retests the previous highs on low volume, it would actually, you know, strengthen my conviction that this is not going to have very much legs past a couple hundred point surge on the S&P. Nonetheless, let's move to a chart on page number 2, where we have that daily chart on the S&P 500. And obviously, for the last 3 months, we've been putting that market correction template up, talking about the typical duration of market corrections. And what's really interesting here is that without us having made lower lows in this month of May, then it really does still fit the bill of what a typical market correction would have been, which is it lasts anywhere from about 8 to 12 weeks in total duration, pull back somewhere in the 10 to 20% range, often retest a low at least once. In this case, we almost had like a W-shape kind of double bottom. And now we're having a breakout that is actually demonstrating some technical conviction. Now, if we go to page number 3, where we broke it down to a 4-hour chart, so we can more look at the intraday technical stuff on the charts, we can see that we're actually traded right up to the highs from April, which is right around this kind of 2700 to 2720 area on the upside. Now, this is definitively a breakout of the trend line I've drawn. To me, this is a key breakout, and I suspect that we're going to rally into the summer. There isn't a technical reason for me to really believe that this is not going to happen. But what is really interesting is the cross current, because you really have a huge amount of headlines coming out that seem so bearish on the surface. Like there was a headline about Ray Dalio and Bridgewater, or Dan Loeb at Third Point, increasing their short books and reducing their net longs. And it seems almost to feel like counterintuitive to be bullish or long the market when some of the biggest money players, the headlines seem to be coming out so bearish. But I think that there's still room here for these cross currents to be a tail between the short-term path of the markets versus the big longer-term outlooks. Because I do still believe generally that this is going to become a big topping formation for the top of the bull market and subsequently a bear market on the other side. And so, you know, it really is about what is the short-term path. And I think a short-term path for a summer rally is still the path of least resistance here for the markets.
Well, Patrick, I've got to hand it to you on that one, because at that point in May, we were down in, you know, in the 2600s, and everybody thought we were headed straight down from there, and you really called it. You said perhaps a rally back to test the prior highs. We went actually slightly higher than the prior highs, but it did happen on low volume. You said that that would increase your conviction that even if we did get back to the old all-time highs, that we were still looking at a topping process that was going to head eventually into a bear market. And at least as we're recording middle of the month in December here, it's really looking like we're starting to get back into that bear market that you predicted. So we'll be looking forward to more of your big picture trading chart books as we come into 2019.
Yeah, and it worked out this year. I want to say this with humility, because the market always has a way of playing that role of the great humiliator. But so far this year, it's our call on the S&P worked out perfectly. I went into the 2018 market forecast that I did in late December, and one of my calls was that not only were we going to have a violent market correction of 10+%, but that was only going to be a correction, but rather the entire 2018 year was going to be one big topping formation. That was a call that I had right from the get-go. And so far, it really does feel like it's playing out that way. It's certainly going to raise the bar for me to get it right for 2019. But let's see how this plays out.
Patrick, around the same time that you made that call, we also had Russell Napier on the program, and I asked him the same question that I asked Darius Dale about the risk of contagion from China. Let's listen to what he had to say. There's the old expression that when the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold, because there is just so much dominance that the U.S. dollar plays in the rest of the financial system. It seems to me that their credit risk, if you look at China's credit growth since 2009, I mean, it's just off the charts in terms of crazy, crazy credit growth. In terms of contagion risk, if China not only sneezes but gets outright credit pneumonia, is the contagion risk there to the rest of the world in terms of bringing on a global crisis, or do you think it would be contained in China and, say, in surrounding Asian economies?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question, because we've always said that about America, haven't we? And to some extent, it's been true, but we don't live in this kind of unipolar world anymore. We now have this huge second largest economy in the world, and it has been important. It's been crucially important for countries such as Australia and Canada in terms of resources and so on, you know, and also for the rest of Asia. So the key contamination from China to the rest of the world is the exchange rate. It's not necessarily lower growth in China. It's not necessarily a credit event in China. It's if China had to solve those problems via a lower exchange rate, and that's the transmission mechanism. When America sneezes, the world catches a cold. It's true. I would also say when the dollar rises, the world catches a cold, because so many of the emerging markets have linked to the dollar, and therefore just a rising dollar, even against the background of a reasonably buoyant U.S. economy, can cause havoc in emerging markets. I would go back to the late 1990s again, 1997, 1998. The U.S. economy was doing fine, but the dollar was going up, and many, many emerging market economies went bankrupt. They had too much debt. The dollar went up. Liquidity tightened.
It was great to have Russell on the show, and I just want to give some context about price levels, because at the time when he started talking about the emerging markets and the stresses that were going to emanate in emerging markets, we just finished a period where from 2016 to January of 2018, emerging markets were one of the best performing asset classes, up 85% in just a couple of years. Subsequently, we were about flat on the year. We had a big correction in February in the emerging markets, but they weren't down on the year when Russell came on. So him coming on and giving us perspective that a lot of the selling was going to come in emerging markets was very timely. So let's listen into the second clip, because we asked him later in the interview, because he wrote the book on bear markets, what was going to be the asset classes at the greatest risk during the next bear market. Let's have a listen.
Well, let's talk about that then. You wrote the book on bear markets. It sounds to me like you think there has to be a wholesale liquidation of some other asset in order to provide this treasury funding. I have to believe that other asset is stocks. So what do you see on the horizon in terms of what comes next for equity markets?
Yeah, it has to be portfolio assets. It has to be something that's liquid. Stocks are the one we think of, but corporate bonds are another one. And just to stress, it could be government bonds of countries other than the United States of America that currently have very low yields. So I'm negative on stocks because I see the liquidation, but I find it very difficult to point to a specific asset class that's going to be liquidated apart from emerging market equities, because it's the obvious one. Because the things that are going on in America, it's not, I mean, there's this liquidation going on, but these things that are happening in America, higher rates of interest, a stronger dollar, perhaps lower growth, perhaps not lower growth, really, really, really have the biggest impact on those countries that have borrowed dollars. So as we begin to see fundamental impacts, so we're saying real economy impacts, where will they be at the greatest? The real economy impacts would be greatest in emerging markets. But for the reasons I mentioned, I think it flow through into Europe. It would be easier to liquidate these equities, corporate bonds, that it would be liquidated American equities and corporate bonds, because they're in the very firing line of a deteriorating fundamental position. And estimating the United States economy is much more difficult because of the scale of the fiscal stimulus. So yes, liquidation across the board of equities, but perhaps a U.S. equity market that outperforms even if it falls, because the real economic impacts could easily fall outside of America. When America sneezes, the world catches a cold. When the dollar goes up, the world catches pneumonia.
Well, Eric, Russell was bang on. We should have him back on the show as soon as possible. And just to, for our listeners, at the time when we recorded this, the emerging markets from their peak price this year to the bottom end of the trough were down 28%. So his call was bang on.
Patrick, you're absolutely right. Russell nailed that call. We really got to get him back on the program soon because he's one of my favorite guests of all time. But another really excellent guest is, of course, David Rosenberg from Gluskin Chef. We had him on July 19th. And the first question that we wanted to ask him was exactly because you had told us that we should expect a rally into the summer. We were getting one. The question was, is this really maybe a resumption of a new all-time highs and a new bull market, or is this cycle over? Let's see what he said. What's the current update on your outlook on the market? Are we looking at maybe that last hurrah, or is this cycle finally ending?
Well, I think it's probably more the latter. It's interesting that Jeremy Grantham made that comment just as we were hitting that January 26th peak in the S&P 500. I think actually the blow-off already had happened in January when heading into the all-time highs, the S&P 500 was up almost 8%. And, you know, that doesn't happen every single day. That was in less than a month. And I remember all the headlines saying at the time that this was the best start to the year, the best January we've ever seen since 1987. And my retort was, well, when I go back and poll people about 1987, January is not the month they remembered, it's October. So I would actually say, I mean, I don't know where 60% increase in the stock market from where we were in January, where that would possibly come from. But my sense is that the blow-off phase already happened after the tax cuts were announced in December and into January. I think that was the last, you know, parabolic move to the highs. And we just put in a classic topping formation ever since. This market is looking very toppy. The breadth measures are looking increasingly, you know, less impressive. And the yield curve is flattening, not inverted yet. But my sense is that, you know, some indices like the NASDAQ put in a high very recently. You can look at the Russell 2000. To me, the S&P 500 is the bellwether. And until otherwise notified, you know, it's been a good 7 months since we last saw a high. And until we revisit that, to me, this is a classic choppy trading pattern of the market.
Well, Patrick, I'm going to score David 8 or 9 out of 10 on that one. It's true that he thought we would not get back to a new all-time high. We did break to a new all-time high, but it lasted for, what, 5 weeks or something? And then exactly what he has predicted really started coming true. And meanwhile, all of the narrative about what was going on, the rally on soft volume, it's basically the yield curve flattening. He said it hasn't inverted yet. Of course, now it has. So he really made the call. And the only thing he got wrong is we did get a brief revisit of all-time highs before everything that he anticipated played out. But I want to come to a more specific question that I asked him later in that interview, because I said, when we get to everything selling off, where is the most risk in the market? And this subject of triple B rated credit came up. So let's listen to that clip now. To page 42, where you get into this huge overhang of corporate debt that is just one ratings downgrade away from being downgraded to junk status. And of course, there's a reinforcing cycle that always kicks in there. If things get downgraded to junk, institutional holders are forced to sell them. They don't have a choice because they're no longer in investment grade, and that just pushes the price down further. But a whole lot of people have been speculating that that's what's going to really give out next is going to be the junk bond market. But I also noticed, I just saw this week, that we've got record high short interest in the junk bond ETFs. And of course, that could be a setup for a short squeeze. So do you think this junk bond market is finally ready to let go here, or do we maybe still have more time to wait?
Well, what's interesting is that the real excess might not even be in the high yield market, but actually more in the investment grade market. Because, you know, at the peak of the last credit bubble over a decade ago, only 30% of outstanding debt in the investment grade universe was triple B. Today, that ratio is 50%. So it's really the junkiest investment grade universe that you know, that we've ever seen. You know, the reality is that a lot of the energy companies and the high quality ones, during the downdraft in oil prices a couple of years ago, they got pushed in to the high yield index already. And with oil over $70 a barrel than say 30 or 40, they're pretty well allowing the high yield index to hang in relatively well when you consider they're 20% of the high yield market. The real excesses actually are in the investment grade universe this time around. And my sense is that, the Fed seems to have this very rosy scenario, steady she goes. Jay Powell told us that he doesn't sleep at night over the economy. Sounds a lot like Ben Bernanke talking about how the problems of subprime are going to remain contained. And it's not a matter of timing. It's really a matter of understanding where we are in the Fed tightening cycle. And at some point, given how much leverage there is in the corporate bond market, not just high yield, but investment grade, and the volumes, the record volumes of debt refinancings taking place in the next few years, because we will be paying the piper at higher interest rates, the default rate's going to rise, credit spreads are going to widen out, financial conditions are going to tighten, and that's going to generate the inevitable recession. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, and I could be early on the call like I was back in 2007. But I am suggesting that people, if you don't open the umbrella, just make sure you have one on you.
Eric, he absolutely nailed that one. And really, it took us 5 months to get Professor Edward Altman onto the show. We had him right now on December 13th. Those of you that haven't caught that interview, you can go back and listen to it. But really, there's a lot of risks associated with the corporate bond markets. And what's interesting is that there's increasing number of people that are now turning to the investment grade component of the bond market where they feel the risks are. It was Louis Vincent Gave, when we had him in the postgame, that gave us that one chart that showed that the BBB bond market is almost triple the size of that of the entire junk bond market or the high yield market. And any downgrade cycle of that debt could really cause havoc. What's your thinking on that now?
Well, my thinking is evolving because just as David Rosenberg described in this interview, and we've talked to Louis Vincent Gave about, the risk is all that BBB rated credit. If it were downgraded, that would force institutions to sell it whether they want to or not, and that could create massive problems. And I think a lot of people are seeing that there is a huge amount of risk in that paper, and there's a lot of good reason to think it should be downgraded. And I think people are extrapolating, okay, not sure when, but it's going to happen. And when it does, it's going to be carnage. Well, if it happens, it's going to be an absolute slaughter. That's for sure. What I'm realizing more and more, Patrick, is this falls into the category of things that regulators, I don't think they're at all above just telling the rating agencies, look, whatever you do, don't downgrade all those triple Bs. I don't care if they're ought to be downgraded, don't do it because it's going to create a systemic risk. A lot of people have woken up to that systemic risk, and I wouldn't be surprised, perhaps not yet, but at some point in the future, if regulators will tell the rating agencies, look, guys, you got to look the other way and just don't downgrade this stuff. We don't want to force institutions to have to sell stuff that's going to create another credit crisis. So the big caveat that's forming in my mind, Patrick, is I'm not convinced when it comes time for the rating agencies to do their jobs and downgrade that debt to junk status when it becomes junk status, whether they're really going to do that or if somebody will have whispered in their ear and said, look the other way, guys.
All right. Well, let me ask you this, Eric. Even if they don't downgrade the debt from a status perspective, the market, wouldn't you think, through price discovery would simply be treating the BBB rated bonds as though they were junk, even though they weren't downgraded? Wasn't that the case what was happening with General Electric already? Even though they weren't downgraded, their bonds were already trading like junk. I mean, just because they weren't officially rated, does that not still create the same risks? I guess the funds that hold them wouldn't be forced to sell them. I think that's what you're getting at, isn't it?
Right, and I think it's all about expectations. As long as there's a fear that that stuff is about to be downgraded or might be downgraded and that could result in a forced selling, then there's already going to be depressed pricing in those securities because people are afraid of what could happen in a downgrade. If it becomes clear to the market that the rating agencies have been asked to look the other way and not downgrade the triple Bs because of the systemic risk that doing that, even if it's their job, would result in, I think at that point you breathe a sense of relief where people who were selling those on speculation that they would be downgraded realize that the downgrade's not imminent and you actually see a rally in that triple B rated credit. So I think it's all about perceptions and what the market's going to do. But it does occur to me, if we get to 2008 size credit crisis starting to unfold, the Fed knows that they don't have the ammunition that they did in 2008 to fight it with. They're going to be early and they're going to branch out to unconventional options in telling, including, I fear, telling the rating agencies not to do their job. You know, and admittedly, that's my own conjecture, conspiracy theory, if you want to call it that. But I just want to make sure that we realize the reason people are so focused on those triple Bs as opposed to the junk is because of the fear of, if they got downgraded, the reflexive action that would occur. If they don't get downgraded, there's already a lot of speculative downside built into the price that could come out in the other direction.
All right. Well, let's move on because the show just keeps getting better because now we get to the FANG stocks. And so to give our listeners a little bit of context, it was back in late July that Facebook came out with a disappointing news and essentially had that massive gap lower. And it was a week later on the 2nd of August that we had Jesse Felder on the show talking about FANG stocks and his view about them in a bigger topping formation. Let's have a listen and then we'll talk about it.
Referring again for listeners in your Research Roundup email, you've got a link to Jesse's blog post where there are several more charts talking about how the FANG stocks may be a leading indicator of what's coming next. Walk us through the blog post. Tell us what the summary is of what your expectations are based on this information.
There's been actually a lot of deterioration in the stock market this year outside of the FANG stocks. You know, the FANG stocks and the NASDAQ recently hit a new high, but most of the other indexes peaked in, you know, what, late January, early February. And you look at like the NYSE Composite and the Dow, and they're not close to making new highs, even while the FANG stocks are. This is really, to me, reminiscent of the 2000 topping process. When the Dow hit a new high, its final high in December, I think, of 99, the NASDAQ peaked in March of 2000, and then the NYSE Composite actually made a new high, I think, in the fall, maybe September of 2000. And they all kind of made separate peaks and then rolled over into late 2000, early 2001. And I think we could be seeing something like that again right now, where most indexes peaked in January, February, but the NASDAQ is making new highs right now, even while the NYSE Composite remains well off its own. And it's really just been the FANG stocks that have been holding up the broader markets lately. But, you know, with Facebook and Netflix really getting hammered last week, and deservedly so. I mean, these stocks trade at their highest valuations in their short histories, even as their growth is really slowing down and profitability at Facebook is looking, you know, is deteriorating really rapidly, and Netflix has no profitability to speak of. So if investors are starting to think about these things in a different way and say, wait a second, what were we pricing into these stocks, right? If we're willing to pay the highest valuations in their history, that means there's a lot of assumptions embedded in there, like their growth is going to continue, that their profit margins will stay high, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, these are also the same assumptions that are embedded in the broader stock market. When you look at the S&P 500, the median price to sales ratio is completely off the charts. This is another valuation metric, 50% higher than it was at the peak of the dot-com mania. And you think about what the assumptions that are embedded in that. Well, it's that profit margins are going to stay high, growth is going to stay good, interest rates are going to stay low, et cetera, et cetera. That's what it means to be priced for perfection. And if perfection does not materialize, then you have to have a reckoning between expectations and reality. And I think that's what we're seeing with Facebook and Netflix currently. And I think those stocks in particular have plenty of room to the downside just from the valuation standpoint if they continue to disappoint. And that's also true for the broad market too, that if growth and profitability does not live up to investor assumptions right now, there's going to be a similar reckoning for the broad market. And it probably means, you know, I mean, how do you get this long-term forecast that the Buffett indicator is saying where you lose 2 or 3% a year over 10? Well, you have to have probably some type of a bear market that brings valuations back to reality, some type of a historical average. If that's the case, it leaves plenty of downside for the markets. I do believe, I think, that this reckoning that's going on in the FANG stocks could be representative of a broader reckoning of valuation, like I was mentioning. And it really, to bring me back to 2000 again, you know, Intel, it was the fall of 2000 where Intel missed earnings. And you look at what were the greatest one-day drops in equity value in history. Well, Facebook just set the record last week when it lost $120 billion in a day. I think it was like number two or three on the list was Intel, and that was September of 2000 when Intel dramatically disappointed investors, and that marked a turning point for the dot-com mania. That was kind of like the final nail in the coffin where the NASDAQ peaked in March, Intel disappointed in September, and it was just, you know, off to the bear market from that point. I think there's a good chance that Facebook last week could be, you know, our version of Intel in the fall of 2000.
Well, he really nailed it, Eric. Like making that analogy to Facebook being the Intel of 2000 and that drop was meaningful. Since that drop in Facebook, Facebook has proceeded to, from its peak at 220, a gap down to, let's say, 180. I'm just rounding 175 or something like that. But it continued to sell off into November, hitting a low of about 125. I mean, the selling has been relentless. And one FANG stock after another FANG stock, and just a couple months ago with the break in Apple, each general within this bull market is being shot in the field and the troops are scattering. It really does feel like something is very different this time. That's a dangerous phrase to say, but it really feels that the bull market has run its course. What's your feeling?
Well, I don't know that it's dangerous to say that. I mean, if you look at Jesse Felder's track record, he has made this argument correctly for a while, and this time he got the timing exactly right. I don't think that Jesse Felder was wrong when he said, watch out for this bubble in the FANG stocks, you know, 6 months earlier than that. He had it right then. It was just a question of when it was finally going to break. And it certainly feels, as we're recording this again in mid-December, that it looks like we're really headed to the downside. We saw that consolidation looked almost like a bear flag pattern with kind of a bottom range of 2600 to 2620 top at 2800 to 2820. We have, as we're taping this, just on the day we're taping this, we've broken down below that range, and it looks like we're headed lower still. So it remains to be seen exactly where we're headed, but certainly expectations that were so widespread. How many times had Marko Kolanovic gone, redoubled down on his bullish expectations? We're headed to 3,000 by whatever it was, the first quarter. Well, if that's coming, it hasn't come yet, at least as of this recording. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. But I think that as we called on our early season shows, the 2008 was primarily about a big topping pattern, and it looks like we're over. And I think we are headed lower. Are we headed into recession in late 19 or 2020? Probably. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens next.
All right, well, let's move on because I want to get to Charlie McElligott. He's been one of our more popular episodes, and we had him on the show on the 13th of September. And while a lot of things have changed, what was really a very important part of that interview, which I took away, was the whole late cycle and the dynamics of how liquidity is shifting within the markets as the central banks are winding off all of their easing. So let's have a listen to the interview we just had with Charlie.
Yeah, so I just, you know, again, I think context is important when you look at prior cycles, prior recessions, and what I want to communicate here is that by the time that the Fed has, in that lower panel, the yellow line, by the time that the Fed has stopped hiking in the kind of months and, you know, 1 or 2 years prior, you've seen near-term peaks in the auto sector and the home builder sector. And that makes sense, right? This is very rational. These are incredibly interest rate sensitive parts of the economy. And those sectors in particular begin to pick up on this fact, right? I mean, if it's simple. There's an initial, after a Fed hike, there's an initial impulse that, you know, that then creates, you know, higher mortgage rates, that then creates buyers to kind of move to market. You know, got to get off the pot and transact in this house. Well, you got that, and now you're fading. And obviously part of this story here, too, is inflation. There's inflation and the tariffs and building products and things like that, and this current kind of slower fade, steeper fade in the home builder space. But these are large purchases, right? These are large purchases, 30-year mortgages, large auto loans. They're very interest rate sensitive. And both of these sectors are incredibly cyclical and pick up on this late cycle shift, frankly, that back to that bottom panel is telling me that we are probably nearing the end of the Fed's hiking cycle. You know, that I think is kind of my major message here is that I think there's an increasing likelihood that 2019, even though the Fed is currently telling us that there's, you know, they're projecting 3 hikes, the market is only pricing in 44 bips of hikes versus the Fed's 75 bips, that there's an increasing likelihood that the Fed might have to pause, if not never get to those 3 hikes. And this is just another kind of signal that we are very late in the process.
Eric, the one thing I want to give kudos to Charlie, he was one of the first people that came out and started talking about the idea that all these rate hikes that are being priced into 2019 may slowly come off the table. And one of the interesting aspects, at the time we're recording this, we have not yet heard the result of the FOMC meeting, whether they raised here in December or not, but the consensus is that they will. But there are a growing number of people that believe December will be the last rate hike. All of the rate hikes in 2019 are now being fully taken off the table, but Charlie was one of the first ones to call that. But the other really neat thing about his call was his timing on both the autos and the home builders, because after he made those calls, being on the show on September 13th, the autos were down about 15% since that interview. And then when we go to the home builders have more or less dropped almost 20%. And that happened pretty much in a month right after he was on the show. Now, he didn't necessarily say they were going much lower, but he was showing that that's the late cycle dynamic. And that really has been playing out. What did you take away from it?
Well, I agree with everything you said, and I would emphasize particularly, you know, this interview was in the middle of September. In other words, just after the S&P had broken out to a new all-time high, and the bulls were all saying, okay, you guys that thought that the top was in were wrong, we're headed off, it's an all-time new high, we're headed towards 3,500, whatever they were saying. Charlie was very clear in saying, look, all the indicators were late cycle here. You know, he didn't know exactly when it was going to roll over, but it was very obvious to him where we were headed. And as you say, he was one of the first to really see that the Fed hiking cycle might be coming to an end sooner than other people thought it. Now, the other guy who made that call a little bit later and even more clearly was Keith McCullough. Now, on the day that we recorded this clip with Keith, it was November 15th. The 10-year Treasury was at 3.11. It had come down from 3.25. What almost everybody was saying at the time was, okay, that 3.25, that was a clear breakout. It means we're headed towards higher yields. We have to come back down and test the previous breakout level, which is around 3.10 to 3.12. And we got to test that as support. And from there, we're going to the moon. We're headed to 4%. Listen to what Keith said when everybody else said we're headed higher in yield and everybody thought that the Fed hiking cycle was going to continue into next year. Let's listen to Keith. I'm going to go ahead and skip ahead again to slide 23, where we get into what you're actually looking for in terms of Q3 2018 macro themes. Walk us through these three themes and why they're important.
A theme's important when it's new and then it starts to trend. So our call on the U.S. dollar, we called the dollar breakout in April, and then we reiterated in Q3 that the dollar should strengthen at this point, so we're going to stay with that in as much as shorting emerging markets on all bounces to lower highs. So again, if you're HedgEye power users, you know what to do. At the top end of the risk range, which we publish daily, that's where you make your sales. You don't sell them just because they're up. You sell them when they're up and at the top end of the range. So a good example of that, obviously, is the four-day U.S. equity bounce that we had coming out of the midterm election. And then we wrote a note that said huge selling opportunity. So, again, that's what it is. Have interest rates peaked? I think that that's the biggest call left that has not yet worked in a meaningful way. But I do think that the 10-year bond yield is about to break. I just need it to break 305 on the 10-year yield. And I think there's a trap door underneath that towards 250 on the 10-year yield. And I don't think anybody else thinks it can go there. At least they haven't published that forecast. Maybe there is somebody. And if they want to be in my lonely corridor with me on that, then that's great. Quad 4 is the bigger theme, which is on slide 24. We're just rolling through.
Hey, hang on one second, Keith. One second before you go on. Let's come back to rates, because there is such a chorus of people that are just so convinced. Look, you saw the breakout past 3 spot 10, 312, whatever you want to call the magic number on the 10-year, got all the way up to 320-something, came back and retested that 312 level as support. It held, moved higher. There's so many people that just say, that's it. The secular bond bear market is upon us. Give us the rationale. Why do you disagree on a fundamental level with those views?
Well, one, the easiest way that I always disagree is that most people are just looking at a chart. I mean, there's a lot more to this than just looking at a chart. You know, anybody can look at what I affectionately call the 200-day moving monkey or the 50-day moving monkey. I mean, they're one-factor models. We get it. If you pull the chart back far enough on 10-year yields, you get almost every traditional technician is going to tell you it was a breakout in as much as every technician, Eric, because you know, told you that the Russell looked fine at the end of August, and so did the NASDAQ. Subsequently, they've both gone down on the order of 12 to 15%, and now the charts look bad. So that's the whole point of having a research process that front runs the turns in the technicals. And that's really when I look at it. I mean, I don't look at other people's technicals. I look at my own quantitative signal. And as I pointed out, as inflation data points come out lower, I think the Fed is going to go from hawkish to dovish. So I think they're going to raise rates for the last time in December. And if they continue raising rates during a quad four slowdown, then the markets, you know, the stock market's going to go down faster, and they're going to have to eventually cut rates faster anyway. So I really think that in the next 3 to 6 months, all my catalysts are really in the forward-looking outlook. And today, it would be very hard for people that don't agree with me to see those things, because people that see those things are just looking at a chart. And, you know, once they start to hear the Fed turning from hawkish to dovish, and then eventually I think the Fed's going to have to start cutting interest rates again, it'll be way too late to be buying long-term bonds. And that's effectively the point when I look at that. Another big thing that people call out is, of course, the gargantuan amount of Treasury issuance. You know, all the reasons why we could have given you to be bearish on bonds and bullish on bond yields for 2.5 years are clear. You know, bonds have been going down for 3 years, long-term bonds have, for a reason, and so is the short end of the bond market as well. I just think the cycle has peaked, again, on inflation, but also on growth and also on earnings. So the three-legged stool of peaks, called the triple peak, is the main reason why we have that outlook on bond yields going lower, making lower highs effectively from that 325, 323 level for now, for a year now, for that matter.
Eric, he nailed it. No sooner did we finish that than within a week or two, that 305 handle was broken on the 10-year yield, and we are 30 basis points lower than where he made that call, just over a month old from when he made it. Now, obviously, a lot of stuff can happen, and it's only 1 month in, but at least right now, it appears to have been a great call.
Absolutely. And we should again mention, we recorded this a couple of weeks before you heard it, folks. So we're looking at low 280s on the 10-year yield. It may be another story by the 27th of December when you hear this episode. But in any event, I think that Keith's call here was extremely prescient, and it's very much really causing me to bring into question, okay, the dollar has been the most important thing to get right all year long. And as much as we have been right about it, at least for the last 6 months or so, we've really got to start to question. There's a lot of good reasons to think the dollar continues to move higher. There's a lot of reasons to think that if the Fed pauses, once that's confirmed, that it's done, and that the dollar might start to move lower at that point. So I'm definitely going to be looking to ask a number of our guests as we go into 2019 what their dollar outlook is. Overall, Patrick, what did you take away from all of these clips and pulling this show together?
Eric, it's really just easy to summarize. We bring on the smartest guests onto the show, and they've been nailing it all year long. I'm looking forward to 2019. We have an absolutely phenomenal lineup of guests that we are already scheduling for the new year. And I think that they're just going to keep making great calls all year long. I'm looking forward to 2019.
Well, Patrick, I'm definitely looking forward to the coming year as well, both to get all of these guests back on the program, to get updates for their perspectives, as well as for us to continue to work on finding new voices. There's a lot of smart people in the world of finance, and I look forward to continuing to bring more of them to you in the coming year. Folks, if you've enjoyed our year-end show and if you've enjoyed Macro Voices over the last year, we hope you'll consider making a donation this holiday season. The show is entirely supported by your generosity. It wouldn't be possible without your donations. And we all know that you don't want us to bring advertising on. So please help us avoid that need if you're able to. So we're going to leave it there for our year-end show. Patrick and I both wish you and yours a fantastic and safe holiday season. We'll be back 3rd of January with an exciting guest and another fantastic program.
And just as a reminder, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. And you could also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and follow myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening. Happy holidays, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.